This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In March 1981, two members of the Ku Klux Klan brutally murdered a 19-year-old black teenager named Michael Donald in Mobile, Alabama, and hung his body from a tree. The ugly lynching sparked a major court case against the United Klans. The men involved were arrested and convicted, and Donald's mother, Beulah May Donald, with the help of a white lawyer named Morris Dees, won a historic $7 million settlement from the United Klans in 1987. Dees, the co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center, has devoted his life to undermining hate groups like the Klan, telling the riveting story of the journey toward justice for what was the last Klan lynching in the U.S. is my guest, Lawrence Leamer. He is the New York Times best-selling author of more than a dozen books, including The Kennedy Women, The Price of Justice, and more. He now joins me to discuss his new book, The Lynching, the epic courtroom battle that brought down the Klan. Welcome to the show, Lawrence.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, this was a very fascinating story, and one of the first things that shocked me, but maybe it shouldn't, is that this last lynching of this 19-year-old young man happened in 1981, not in the 60s or 70s, but in the early 80s. And that was quite shocking that it, you know, that there were lynchings happening this late. However, I understand that this was the first lynching in something like 25 years in the US?
Yeah, well, you imagine from about 1870 to 1955, there was averaging one a week or more than one a week throughout the Deep South. It was the way that black people were intimidated and held down. Imagine psychologically what it did to know that if you're a black person, you might be just plucked up off of the street and hanged. In 1890, there was a lynching in Texas where 12,000 people came to see the lynching. So the lynching, or the idea of a lynching, was very much in the black soul. In 1955 was the last one. Then on a Saturday morning in March of 1981, people woke up that morning, and there's this black body on Herndon Avenue, Alabama. And the black people that showed up and to see this and begin to cry and pounding their fists against the ground, they knew it was a lynching. Nobody had to tell them. The police didn't have to investigate. They knew this was a racial mixing and this horror of lynching coming back to haunt them once again.
So Mobile, Alabama in the late 70s, early 80s, how active was the Klan in this part of the country, and how linked was it to some of the highest echelons of power?
Well, the Klan, you know, in the 1920s, the Klan was like the Rotary Club in lots of places. In Indiana, the governor was a Klansman. The legislature in Oregon was controlled by Klansmen. But by the time we're talking about, it was kind of a group of kind of dispirited lower class. And one of the strongholds was Southern Alabama. And this group of Klansmen had a meeting the week before the lynching. There had been a bank robbery in Birmingham, Alabama. A black bank robber had gone and robbed the bank. When he came out, he shot and killed a policeman. They felt that trial couldn't be held in Birmingham. It was too controversial, too much anger. So they brought it down to Mobile, and it was heard before a larger black jury. The Klansmen got together at their meeting, and they said, you know, if this guy gets off, then we're going to kill a black man in retribution. Late that Friday afternoon, the jury came back with his verdict, and it was a hung verdict. Later, he was convicted, but it was a hung verdict that time. So these two Klansmen, a 17-year-old and a 25-year-old, were deputized to go out and find a black man and kill him, and that's precisely what they did.
So tell us about the two men that were involved. I mean, basically, they were trying to send a message, right? This was, they thought, going to make the or encourage other Klansmen around the country. This was going to lift their spirits. Henry Hayes and James Knowles. How high up in the chain of command of the United Klans in Mobile, Alabama, were they? Were they sort of lower level folks? Were they leaders?
Well, Tiger Knowles was only 17 years old, but he'd grown up in a Klan family. And he was already a major official of the state Klan. And he envisioned one day becoming the Imperial Wizard of the Klan, the highest official in the United Klans of America, the biggest Klan organization in the country.
So,
and his partner in crime, Henry Ace, his father, was the leading Klan official in the southern half of the state.
So what about Michael Donald, the victim? How much do we know of him? His mother, Beulah May Donald, is a major character in the story of this whole thing. But the boy himself, he was 19 when he was minding his own business, walking home alone, and simply picked out because he was African American. And, you know, just this, the tragedy is that we would, of course, never know what he might have achieved, but what and the kind of person he might have grown up to be. He was still just a child. What do we know about him?
Well, he was a clean cut young man. He was working as a paper folder at the local newspaper. He was going, getting trained to become a bricklayer. He was the youngest of seven children. He was living with his mother. He was staying at home that Friday evening watching a basketball game. And his aunt wanted some cigarettes. And she asked him if he'd go out and get cigarettes. So at 11 o'clock, he takes his aunt gives him a dollar bill. That's all he has in his wallet. He goes out looking for cigarettes. And lo and behold, this car comes, this old Buick comes by, Tiger Knowles pulls a gun on him and orders him in the car. And then they drive out into the wilderness. Now, he knew, as a black man, he knew these two white men pick you up. He knew what was going to happen. I mean, he wasn't a militant guy. He's just in that car, and he knows what's going to happen. He says, "Don't kill me. Please, I beg you, don't kill me." They get out into the wilderness, into this clearing there, and they get outside. And he fights for his life. He bravely, heroically fights. They knock him down and knock him out. He gets up three different times. The hanging rope of the trunk, they pull the rope around his neck and put one of them puts his foot on his head and pulls it tight and strangles him to death. And then to make sure, they cut his throat. They cut his throat. And now, they could have left the body, you know, buried it there or left it in the ocean. Nobody would have known, probably. But they wanted, the whole point of the lynching is to show to black people, to frighten black people. So they brought the body back in the trunk into Herndon Avenue in Mobile and hung it up in a tree.
So who was Beulah May Donald, and how did she fight for justice for her son? In reading about her in your book, her determination reminded me of the determination of Emmett Till's mother, a woman who wanted to know what happened to her son, wanted the world to see the open casket so that they could see how badly her son was mutilated. Was Beulah May Donald, in a way, sort of channeling that same determination and yearning for justice for her son's death?
Yeah, and of course she insisted on an open casket too, so people could see what had been done to her son. But the people that came to the funeral were the friends and family. They knew they didn't have to see the open casket. It was the Klansmen, and people like that should have seen. But she was a woman, a poor, uneducated woman, and she grew up at a time in the South when, you know, black people could just disappear sometimes. Sometimes they were just gone. And they were forgotten. Nobody knew. And she didn't want her son to be forgotten. She knew this was a horrible thing. And when these two young Klansmen were arrested, and Morris Dees, who's the co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center, he came down and was sitting in the courtroom, and he felt, you know, this isn't enough. These two young men are being convicted, but this doesn't come from them. They were young. They had to learn to do this from others. They had to learn from the top of the organization. They had to learn from Robert Shelton, the Imperial Wizard of the Klan. And I'm going to sue the Klan, and I'm going to do my darndest to bring the Klan down for good.
Right, and so let's talk about Morris Dees, the other hero of this story. He had founded the Southern Poverty Law Center in 1971, considered one of the great lawyers in the United States. What was his interest in seeing, seeing the lawsuit that would end the United Klans in Mobile, Alabama, or at least in Alabama. What motivated him to participate in this case?
Well, Morris Deese, he'd been a segregationist as a child. He'd been George Wallace's student campaign manager in 58. He defended a Klansman in 1961 who had brutally beaten people in the Montgomery busing in the Freedom
Ride. Sort of had his own evolution, political evolution.
Yeah, he says he didn't know that his client was a Klansman. But nonetheless, he evolved. He slowly changed, and he became very pro-integration and outspoken. And he got in a lot of trouble. The Southern Poverty Law Center was firebombed. Morris's life was threatened when he was down in that courtroom for the trial, for Henry Hayes's trial. They had to, some off private police had to come down and guard him because of the feeling that somebody was going to try to kill him. So he risked a great deal. Even at the Southern Poverty Law Center, there were five lawyers working there. They didn't like this obsessive, what they thought was this obsessive interest in the Klan. They didn't like the fact that their place was being firebombed, that they were in danger for their lives. And they went on to, they quit and went on to do civil rights in a different way. But he went on. He wasn't going to be stopped. And it was a whole new legal theory that he basically invented, that an organization that promotes violence, it is responsible as the individual members who commit the horrendous act.
So then basically the two men who directly killed Michael Donald, Hayes and Knowles, they were arrested, they were convicted. But what Morris Deese essentially made the case was that that you could hold the organization responsible if the action taken by the lower ranked people was part of a directive from up above, you could hold the entire organization responsible?
Well, what happens is that, you know, Morris Deese then decides he's going to file this. He goes to Mrs. Donald, and Mrs. Donald, you know, she wants to get justice for her son. And she is on this, she doesn't care about money. She doesn't care about money at all. She just wants justice. And so she signs her name onto this lawsuit. And so Morris Deese goes and takes all these depositions, and he's got a hard job here. He's got to prove not only that Robert Shelton called for violence, but that there's a pattern of violence. It's just not once. It's like this RICO legislation now that we didn't have back then. He had to prove that. So he found James Rowe, who had been an FBI informant and for several years involved in many violent activities. He was in the car at the time in Selma, at the time of the Selma March, when four Klansmen shot to death Viola Leosa. Okay, and he then gave a deposition to Morris Deese in which he said how before they committed this murder, they had talked to Robert Shelton. Now, Robert Shelton he's a shrewd guy. He doesn't say go out and kill somebody. He says go out and do what we have to do. Don't go out and take care of business. That was the euphemistic language he used. And they went out and killed Bialuasa. There was another young man who was the head of a Klan clavering in a small Alabama town. They'd gone out, they'd shot up the home of a black man who was a civil rights leader who wanted to have blacks and on black people on black men and women on the police force and the fire department. They shot up the home of a white woman who was dating a black man. When the police chief said that he was afraid that this black civil rights leader had called in the FBI, they went and broke into his home and took out his documents to see what kind of letters he had written. And they were caught by the FBI and sentenced to prison. And this man who was the leader who turned state's evidence, he then came into the courtroom and testified. So we had this pattern of these two cases.
So let's talk about then how this particular case that you write about in your book, The Lynching, decimated at least the United Klans. You know, without giving too much away, how active was the Klan after this case wrapped up?
Well, the Klan was, you know, wasn't as active as it was in the 60s, but the people who were left were very, very militant. Now in Mobile, what they did was they called missionary work. Missionary work meant you went out and you found a black person, a black man, you beat him up, you beat him half to death, and you left them there bleeding. You said to him, you know, you better not talk to the police. You talk to the police, they're our Klan brothers. And you talk to the police and we'll come back and kill you. That's what they did. They went out for entertainment to do that.
And what lessons are there to be learned for seeing the Klan today? I mean, we might imagine the Klan now exists in the margins of American society. The Southern Poverty Law Center, which Morris Dees founded, continues its work documenting hate groups, including the Klan. And every now and then the Klan sort of rear their head. We saw in Anaheim, California earlier this year, an altercation. Clearly they're not lynching people anymore because I think they realize they can't get away with it. But do you see this particular courtroom battle as being the most significant deterrent to the Klan since the 80s to now?
Well, it's the most significant deterrent for the Klan organizations, okay? The Southern Poverty Law Center used this theory against other racist and white supremacist groups. So they're pretty much gone. You're not going to find big Klan groups, big Klan organizations, or big white supremacist groups. The problem is that this has become very individualized. The young man who was accused of murdering those people in Charleston, South Carolina, he didn't have to belong to a Klan organization. He could just go on the internet and learn these hateful things. And so it's very difficult for the authorities now. How do you, you know, you can't sort of have undercover agents when it's just one person who reads this stuff on his own and gets a gun and kills people.
And, you know, some people wonder that, you know, whether the history, the ugly racist history of the U.S. is really at rest. You know, if these folks who are sort of fringe, radical, marginalized people are really that fringe, given today the rise of Donald Trump and this resurgence of a politics of racist resentment in this country. From writing your book, what do you make of this current political moment we're in today, where some have even made the links between Klansmen and Trump's father, and Klansmen have come out and said they support Donald Trump, a major presidential candidate?
Well, you know, Donald Trump's campaign, I don't think that Donald Trump personally is a racist, but he certainly has said racist things, and he has...
Well, I would disagree with you personally, but yes, please go on.
Okay, but in any case, he has stimulated racism, okay? He stimulated hatred. He's brought these people out of the shadows, and it's extremely dangerous. They're not members of big organizations. They're very marginalized people. And if he isn't quiet, if he doesn't calm down, I fear what we're going to see during this campaign in the fall. It could be very vicious. It could be deadly. It's a part of American life we want to put behind us. I mean, President Obama said that slavery is America's original sin. So it is. And that sin goes on. Slavery is gone. But this racism is still part of the American soul, I'm afraid.
And then finally, what do you think, you know, through the story that you wrote, do you think justice was served in the case of Michael Donald's horrific lynching, that Beulah May Donald felt that she got justice, that Morris Dees saw this as the peak, you know, the most important thing he did in his career?
Well, I think justice was done. I mean, if Mrs. Donald, the mother of the victim, if she thinks finally justice was done, she feels relieved. Interestingly enough, she didn't want Henry Hayes to die in the electric chair. She didn't believe in the death penalty. She felt that was just more bloodshed and it would be better to have him stay in prison his whole life, every day thinking of what he had done. But she thought she had justice. I mean, look, in a way, what is justice? This young man has died. No matter what you do, you can't bring him back. But in terms of the American justice system, it's about as good as it could have been. Without the people complain about states' rights, and they always talk endlessly of states' rights. Well, if it had what these people call states' rights, the federal government would not have gotten involved. The Justice Department wouldn't have come down. The Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. The FBI wouldn't have come down. And without them, Tiger Knowles and Henry Hayes never would have been convicted. They would, that crime would have gone unpunished. That's why the federal government, in occasions, is so important in this matter, historically. And that's why the civil rights movement, it's not just a story of individuals protesting out on the street, although certainly it was a lawful lot of that. It also was a legal movement. And without the federal government, federal laws, the South would be as segregated now as it was then.
Lawrence, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us and for joining us. Best of luck to you.
Thank you.
My guest is Lawrence Leamer, the New York Times best-selling author of more than a dozen books, including The Kennedy Women, The Price of Justice, and more. We've been discussing his new book, The Lynching, the epic courtroom battle that brought down the Klan. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.